You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
You wouldn't believe the number of people that have local administrator rights, full administrator privileges of their own machines, and they just don't need it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to N2K CyberWire's Hacking Humans podcast, where each week we look behind the social engineering scams, phishing schemes, and criminal exploits that are making headlines and taking a heavy toll on organizations around the world. I'm Dave Bittner, and joining me is Joe Kerrigan from the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
We've got some good stories to share this weekend. Later in the show, my interview with Trevin Edgeworth, a red team practice director at Bishop Fox. We're talking about account compromises at X. We'll be right back after this message from our show sponsor. But first, a word from our sponsors at KnowBefore. Time travel would be a particularly powerful tool in the hands of any overworked InfoSec professional. Think about it. Being able to see the future and know which malicious emails would be missed by all the existing filters. Your ability to stay one step ahead of the bad actors would rise to a whole new level. Unfortunately, our sponsors haven't cracked time travel just yet. They are, however, introducing a new phishing protection product that can block and remove dangerous phishing emails before your users even see them. Stay with us, and in a few minutes, you'll learn how. Okay, Joe, so before we get going here, we have some follow-up. What do we got?
Yeah, first, Aaron writes in to say, hi, from Northern Ireland. Well, hello, Aaron.
Oh, that's nice.
I love the podcast and have been listening for over a year now. I wanted to share something interesting that I found recently. A high-profile politician in Northern Ireland was arrested and charged with a sexual offense, awaiting trial right now.
A politician?
A politician?
I'm shocked.
A sexual offense and a politician?
Right.
Say it ain't so. However, under UK law, it is contempt of court to share the details of the case before it goes to trial. But naturally, everyone is curious and furiously Googling to find this information. Some of the top search results are incredibly suspicious URLs made up of strings of letters and numbers with bold titles promising to give every detail of the case. Mm. I find it interesting that scammers are now keeping up with the news, working out what people are searching for and flooding Google with malicious results. Or perhaps it's automated somehow, and they can just tag on to whatever is trending on Google. That's a good observation,
because mm-hmm.
Google has all those analytics that are out there, and they tell you what's trending.
Right.
So it would be minimal effort to just start using search engine optimization to start injecting malicious sites into the search results.
Yeah.
For whatever's trending on Google.
Yeah.
I have not clicked on any of the links for obvious reasons. But I imagine that they are some sort of phishing or malware. Keep up the good work, Aaron. It doesn't surprise me, but it is novel and interesting, I think. I'm not shocked by this.
Right.
But I hadn't thought of this before.
Yeah, I think Aaron is dead right here, on right that this is what's going on. I'm sure it's automated. Somebody's just taking headlines and maybe even being regional about it and just pumping Google full of fake websites. And you see this all over, people complaining about how the quality of Google search results has just gone down the drain.
It has really, today, Dave, I actually had a question that Google would not answer for me.
Really?
Yeah. So they couldn't tell me what it was. I couldn't find a way to ask it. So I actually wound up asking ChatGPT instead.
Oh,
and I got the
that
answer.
Interesting. And you got an answer.
I got the right answer because then I went back to Google and Googled the answer that I got.
I see. So ChatGPT set you on the right path.
Right.
That gave you the right terms with which to search Google.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, what a circular, horrible way this is to do things.
Right. Right. But it's just unreal to me how bad Google has gotten. It's an ad delivery network that occasionally helps you with search results these days.
Yeah, it's become less and less helpful over time.
Seems like they've lost their way when it comes to that. But I'm not sure how
you would fix that given the way that it can be gamed with, you know, these automated systems taking AI engines and just like we described, taking popular things, news items, and having AI regurgitate them and then pasting them on websites, you know, probably millions of, you know, slightly compromised WordPress sites on phantom pages that just work for Google SEO. And here we are.
Yeah. Mm. That's what happens.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Aaron, for writing in. I do appreciate it. That's an interesting observation. And thank you for sharing that with us. Hmm. We've got another letter here from a reader named Jonathan, or a listener, I should say, named Jonathan, who wrote in. I'll summarize some of the things that Jonathan highlighted. Said that, he was writing in about Apple's non-rate limiting multi-factor authentication.
Right.
And I believe you had referred to it as a vulnerability.
Yes.
And Jonathan took issue with that or not?
He said he did, but eventually he did not.
Okay.
Initially he did, but
so he came around on his own.
Right. He looked it up. Yeah. A vulnerability doesn't have to be something in software.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be, it can be in a system.
Yeah.
It's just something it's something in a system that can be or potentially could be exploited.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, if you have a process for writing checks that one person writes a check and signs a check.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a vulnerability in that process.
Like if I was a bank and I kept stacks of $100 bills right by the front door,
right,
that would be a vulnerability.
That would be a vulnerability, right.
Okay.
A profoundly bad idea to begin with. Nobody would say, but yes, technically, I think that would be a vulnerability.
Here at Joe's Savings and Loan, we keep stacks of $100 bills right by the front door for your convenience.
Take one as you walk out.
What could possibly go wrong? That's funny. Well, thank you, Jonathan, for writing in. Jonathan shared a lot of different things with us, and unfortunately, we don't have time to share all of them, but we do appreciate you writing in. We had another comment from someone named Anders from Sweden who wrote in and said, hi there, just listened to the chat with Robert Blumhof. This article is worthy of a read on same and related topics if you haven't already devoured it, of course. And the article that Anders is talking about is actually a research paper titled Theory is All You Need, AI, Human Cognition, and Decision Making.
Hmm.
I have the abstract here, and basically what this comes down to, I'm going to way oversimplify this.
Okay.
Which is what I do best.
Yes.
So this is saying that human cognition is a process of experimentation. It's a process of strategic decision-making, and that AI uses a data-based approach, data-based approach, using prediction, and that humans use theory-based causal logic.
We're
already down in the weeds, but
yes.
It's an interesting read. I actually did go and check it out, and if you're into this kind of thing, if you're someone who's pondering how AI works and want a thoughtful discussion of what some of the differences may be between how artificial intelligence thinks, I'm putting thinks in air quotes, and how humans do, is an interesting write-up. It's definitely worth your time if that's something that you're into.
So. Is it specifically talking about LLMs or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So yeah, those are more, there have been attempts in the past. Artificial intelligence is a very broad field.
Right.
Right now we're focusing on all these generative things, but the field has been around for decades.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, my research paper for my master's degree back in the early 2000s was an artificial intelligence paper.
Oh, interesting.
But it was now it's not even considered, the problem I was researching is not even considered an artificial intelligence problem anymore. It's an algorithmic problem now.
I'm just imagining your master's thesis paper saying, why Eliza is wrong about everything she's told me, and I hate her very much.
It was, yes.
What was your master's thesis on?
It was on lightweight artificial intelligence route planning algorithms for use in low-cost microcontrollers for use in robotics.
Wow.
So,
can't believe I haven't stumbled across that one, Joe.
No, it never got published. I mean, I can send you a copy of it.
No, but like, I think like most of those things, it's very specific, right?
Right. Yeah. The longer your title, the better your thesis, your research area is.
Interesting.
But basically, I wound up implementing a way to plan a route through a known environment very quickly on a 20 megahertz microcontroller with limited memory.
Wow. Well, that's cool.
Yeah. It was. I had a lot of fun doing it.
I'll bet. These are the days before things like Waze, right?
You know? Well, this is the day before. These are in the days before system on a chip, right?
right.
You get a Raspberry Pi now, and there's no such thing as a low-cost. A low-cost microcontroller at the time was like $8.
Okay.
Right? Now you get a Raspberry Pi Zero for $5 that
right.
has so much more capability.
Right, right. This is why your electric toothbrush can play Doom.
Right? Exactly. That kind of thing. It's, the processing power that's available cheaply now is so much more than, mm-hmm. I probably should have been more forward thinking about my problem, but it was still an interesting problem and I still came up with a pretty good solution, I think.
Yeah, well, good for you. You're more educated than me, that's for sure. I never went past a bachelor's degree.
I got two of those, Dan.
Well, there you go. See, now you're just showing off.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Anders, for sending in this interesting article. We do appreciate it. And we will have a link to that in the show notes. All right, let's move on to our stories here. And Joe, why don't you kick things off for us?
Dave, I saw a story from Sebastian Herrera at the Wall Street Journal.
Hmm.
And I want to bring this up because we don't talk enough. Well, maybe we do, but Amazon has this capability out there for small businesses and individuals to sell products on their platform.
Mm-hmm.
And people can make money on that. I don't know that. I guess people do make money on it because people do it.
Right? Yeah.
You wouldn't be doing it if you were losing money. But this story starts off talking about a woman named Nicole Barton who had to rebuild her business after being swamped with fraudulent returns.
Huh.
She switched from clothing to consumable items like pet food.
Okay.
Right? Things that you can't necessarily return.
Okay.
What she would get, she would send people like Coach wallets, and she would get no-name knockoffs in the return envelope.
Oh.
So she'd send out a real product and get a counterfeit product back. Like, not even a good counterfeit product.
So she was selling authentic items.
Right.
And what was coming back to her were knockoffs.
Right. Knockoffs or there was one case she sold some Nike football cleats and got returned a pair of flip-flops in the box.
Wow.
Another person, Barbara, sells household items but has received cable TV boxes and used soap bars. Now, I don't know about you, Dave, but if I sent something out and got a used soap bar back, I'd be, first off, mad that somebody stole something from me.
Yeah,
but I'd be grossed out as well.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah. Huh.
Another person named Jess sells outdoor coffee products, and they've gotten back Christmas ornaments and toy planes.
Huh.
One person said they sent out human nail clippers and received used dog nail trimmers in return.
So I have an idea what's going on here, but
right.
Unpack it for us.
So what's happening here is Amazon is letting these sellers sell things, and then Amazon lets them take returns.
Right.
Lets the sellers or the buyers return items, and they don't do a lot of work on the the return side.
I see.
And there are either networks of thieves out there and individuals who do this. There are even online forums that coach people in how to make fraudulent returns on Amazon.
Oh.
And there was an executive meeting back in 2004, somewhere around that time frame.
Almost 20 years ago.
Yes.
Wow.
20 years ago, where someone said to Bezos how the company would handle bad actors in the return process,
mm-hmm.
right? And Bezos said that above all, the company would have to put customers first when it came to returns, and that it should be smart enough to use its systems and data to catch bad actors.
Okay.
So here's my thinking on this, Dave.
Yeah.
If you are Amazon or Jeff Bezos, I don't know how involved he is anymore.
Right.
But,
right.
You're Amazon, and you are sending out products to somebody and getting bogus things returned to you,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be much more important to you than if you're also offering your platform service for selling things for people and then they get this is actually a variation of the old retail scam called rocks in a box.
Okay.
Right? Where they put, people would put rocks in a box in return. They go out and buy a VCR. This is how long ago I worked in retail, Dave. I worked at Best Buy. And one of the things that they would say is, watch out for the rocks in the box at the return center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get a sealed up box, even if it looks real, you have to open that box up and take a look inside to see if the item is still in there.
Right.
Because these people do this. But it seems to me that Amazon is not really focusing on the requirements of their platform customers,
mm-hmm.
right? These sellers. They're only focusing on the people that buy things. And I refer to the platform customers as customers. They are customers.
Yeah.
Amazon is just brokering at this point when they're,
right.
when they're setting up this deal between these two people.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a great quote in the article from an Amazon spokeswoman.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
The company has, quote, no tolerance for fraudulent returns on Amazon.
Okay.
She said the company invests significantly in detecting and preventing fraud, including employing teams devoted to the issue, and that it provides resources to sellers who report abuse so they can receive reimbursements.
Hmm.
This sounds almost exactly like last week when I was talking about Facebook and the comment from Facebook.
Right.
Again, I think someone from this big tech company just copied a section out of a list of excuses
right.
that legal has given them and pasted this in an email to the Wall Street Journal.
We take your privacy seriously.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But the problem is that process by which sellers can report these losses, report the abuse, is long and takes so much time that sellers may not have. It's not worth it to them. Additionally, even if Amazon does accept it, the seller may not get the full amount back of what the item cost them. And many times, what sellers wind up doing is just taking the loss.
Yeah.
There is a National Retail Federation statistic in here, a number.
Yeah.
They say that return fraud has become a major issue for our industry. About 13.7% of returns in 2023 were fraudulent.
Wow.
13.7%.
Huh.
What is that, a seventh?
Yeah.
Returns to retail outlets are fraudulent. So I don't know. I'm not so terribly concerned about Amazon. I think they can take care of themselves on this. But it doesn't
right.
look to me like they're taking care of their sellers who are providing goods and or other goods that are then sold. And then Amazon's making a ton of money on the sale, right?
Right. Amazon has little to lose. Amazon has virtually nothing to lose.
Virtually
on this,
nothing to lose.
Right?
Right. Yeah, because if, you know, they, I guess if you're doing this with a, maybe if you're taking advantage of Amazon Prime shipping, but I mean, that's going to be like noise, you know,
yeah.
low level noise losses to them.
I wonder, so, okay, a couple things. First of all, I'm trying to puzzle through the entire process of this scam. So, first of all, I'm wondering, let's make this interesting and just say I'm buying a laptop from you, Joe.
Okay.
Okay. So I buy a laptop, brand new, you know, lovely. Let's say it's a high-end Chromebook.
Okay.
Right? And I buy that from you. Where I guess we think chances are I'm buying this with a stolen credit card.
I don't think that's part of the issue.
Well, let's puzzle through this. Stick with me here.
Okay.
So let's say I buy that with a stolen credit card. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I go to return it and I send back the box of rocks
mm-hmm.
to Amazon. Amazon credits me with the return. Now I've got the stolen laptop or the purchased laptop.
Right.
And I've got the money from the return. So I got a free laptop.
Right.
You get a box of rocks. Amazon isn't out anything.
Right.
I guess what would be... If they were using legit credentials to buy this stuff, the profit comes from the refund on the return.
So
they
yeah,
get the
so here,
stuff and...
Here's a more likely scenario.
Okay.
Somebody opens an Amazon account.
Yep.
They get some gift cards, probably through scamming.
Right.
and they get a gift card balance of $1,000 on their account.
Okay.
They buy the laptop from me.
Yeah.
Right? I send them the laptop. I get $700 credited to my account. Mm-hmm. They then return the laptop with air quotes. And instead of putting in the laptop, maybe they put in, like you said, rocks, or perhaps maybe they go out and buy one of those little VTech kids laptops for $50.
Sure.
Put that in there and send it back to me. And then I have something back. So now I have to go through the return process for Amazon.
Right.
Meanwhile, they're taking this $700 laptop and selling it for $1,000 or $500 in cash.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're pocketing $500. Their account balance still says $1,000 on Amazon.
They've laundered the gift card money.
Laundered the gift card money.
Yeah.
Turn it into cash.
And I'm also thinking of the poor person at Amazon who's handling returns, who, if we know anything about Amazon, it's that they work their people at a frantic pace.
Right, they do.
So that poor person is on some kind of a quota of just, you know, churn.
Yeah.
So I can imagine them opening the box, just glancing inside and seeing, yeah, it looks like a laptop to me, you know, credit, okay, and off it goes.
I've done Amazon returns over at Whole Foods.
Yes.
Here in Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I've just walked in with a box and said, here's my return receipt, you know, my little barcode. They
right.
scan it. They take the box. They throw it in a big bin. They say, have a nice day.
Yeah.
And that's it. They don't even look in the box.
Right.
I don't even think anybody's inspecting it. I think the only problem comes when you have a seller who gets the box back.
Right.
And they open it up. And this is a small business person.
Right.
Maybe they just do this in their spare time to make a little extra cash on the side.
Well, you know what? I think it's worse than that, because I think we're at the point now where certainly if you want to be an online seller, you pretty much have to be on Amazon.
Yeah.
It's so hard. I guess Walmart would be an alternative. I'm thinking of big online platforms, right? I think Walmart would be a distant second, but they are a big online platform.
Right.
But I don't know that you have a choice to not be on Amazon.
Well, I mean, you got things like Shopify
out
there that let you build your own storefront.
Right.
But then you have to drive traffic to your website.
Yeah. I buy a ton of things on Amazon.
Right.
And, I mean, those poor Amazon delivery people are at my house pretty much every day.
Yeah. I know the guy's name that comes to my house. It's Ernesto.
And the reason is it's so easy. And I can get anything. You can get anything on Amazon.
Right.
And as much as I disdain some of their business practices, it's so easy.
Yeah.
So it's hard to reconcile.
I like the convenience, and I like the attitude here that you have a customer focused business.
Right.
I get that. But when you start offering your platform out to other people, you have more than just you and the customer now. You have other stakeholders here, and it looks to me like Amazon is ignoring those stakeholders.
The other thing this makes me wonder about is that quite often I've ordered something from Amazon and it gets delivered,
mm-hmm.
and along with the item, there will be a postcard
right.
that says, and we've seen different postcards. There's the postcards that asks you to review the item,
yes.
those sorts of things. But I've also seen a postcard that says, if you have any issue with this, please do not return it to Amazon.
Yeah.
Please let us know.
Let
we
us
will
know,
do
right.
whatever it takes to make this right. And sometimes, and I've been through that process, and many times they don't want you, they'll send you the replacement, but they do not want you to return it to Amazon because they don't want to be dinged by Amazon for, there's some kind of analytic that
right.
tracks that.
Right.
They don't want to be a provider that's causing a lot of returns.
Yes.
So there's just so much gaming going on. It's just it's a dirty system.
It is. It is.
And it's a shame.
A lot of retailers are asking, customers, resellers, Amazon resellers. They have a name for this program. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But they're asking Amazon to put some friction in the system.
Right.
For the sake of their businesses. Like there should be a delay when the customer sends something back where the customer doesn't get the refund until the seller approves the refund.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are opportunities for that to be exploited by bad sellers, too.
Right.
But if 13% of your returns are fraudulent, I think that merits this kind of attention, this kind of action.
Well, and I think what we're seeing is that Amazon puts the needs of the customer above the needs of the partner reseller.
Right.
And you can understand why when you describe that, that sounds like a good impulse.
Right.
But it opens it up to exactly this kind of fraud.
Exactly.
Interesting. All right. Well, we will have a link to that story in the show notes. I guess, before we move on here, is there anything in terms of people looking out for this? I mean, because this is really, it's really the resellers who are, who have the problem here. It's not the folks, it's not consumers like you and me who are just buying stuff and then legitimately returning stuff.
Yeah. The article talks about an FTC lawsuit, antitrust lawsuit, that's already dinging Amazon pretty hard in a lot of these things.
Okay.
So, like, for example, in order for you to have your items show up in searches, you have to buy Amazon ads.
Mm-hmm.
So they're making, Amazon is not, is favoring people who buy ads against people who, resellers who buy ads against people who don't buy ads.
Right.
Right. And they're essentially making you do this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out over the next several years.
Yes. Yeah, because it's going to be a while.
Right, right. All right. Well, like I said, we will have a link to that story in the show notes. My story this week is a comparatively quick one, I guess. This is an article from Wired. This was written by Reese Rogers, and it's titled, How to Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from AI Scam Calls.
Hmm.
So this is right up our alley.
Yep.
And this article talks about how generative AI is advancing, and of course that allows scammers to create convincing clones of people over the phone and using, you know, little audio clips, and they can even do it in multiple languages. And it's really hard to detect these things because the quality is just getting better and better and it's happening faster and faster. So they have a number of recommendations here for folks to, best protect themselves from these sorts of AI scam calls. Number one on the list, one you and I have talked about many times, hang up and call back.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
And use a known number. Don't use the number that they give you, or, you know, don't give the number that they emailed. Don't use the number that they emailed or the number that shows up on your caller ID.
Yep.
Use a number that you look up on the internet. Although.
Yeah. Don't use Google to do that.
Make sure it's not an ad.
Right.
Right. Make sure the number you look up.
Go to the company's website.
On the internet. There you go. Go to the company's website and get the phone number from there. It's just, it's disheartening, isn't it?
It is. I mean, Dave, there's just so, I mean, it's, I want to go live in the woods, Dave.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, a friend of mine and I in high school, we used to say that if things got too bad, we would go herd sheep in New Zealand. That was our exit plan.
Yeah.
And it's getting more and more, you know, attractive.
New Zealand looks great. It's beautiful.
They're very particular about who they let in, though.
Yeah.
I understand. Like, you can't just go there. You gotta.
You can't just go there.
You
and
gotta want
sheep.
It. No, you. I mean, you can visit, but if you want to stay, you gotta earn it.
Mm. Okay.
One of the other things they talk about here is establishing a secret safe word with loved ones to provide additional security.
Okay.
That makes sense.
It does.
I'd say make it a silly word like abalone or, you know.
Right.
So, because a silly word is easy to remember.
Yes.
You know, have you ever been on the phone with some poor customer support person who's trying to ask you what your secret word is and you go through a list of them? You're like, "Well, it might be baseball. Let's see. It could be Star Wars. Might be and they're like, "No. No. No. You know, you're getting warmer."
Yeah. I keep those in my password manager.
Oh, okay.
In the notes.
Yeah.
So I know.
Oh, for each site.
Right.
Yeah, that's smart. That's smart.
Yeah, for like my banks and any financial institutions.
Right. Right. They say that you can ask personal questions that only the real person would know. They talk about details about recent meals, you know, things like that. Things that are timely and personal that the scammers wouldn't know. I mean, I guess a clever scammer could get around that by saying, I don't have time for those kind
of
details.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, you know? I don't know that you're you, so I don't have time for this either. Goodbye.
Right, right. And they talk about awareness, just being aware that anybody's voice can be cloned now.
That is such a huge thing. And you and I, Dave, we're actually at pretty high risk for this.
Yeah.
Because there's just hours and hours and hours of us talking.
Yeah, thousands of hours.
Right.
But I think the most recent thing from OpenAI, they have an audio generation tool that they're promoting that I don't think they've turned it loose on the world yet, but they've been running demos of. And it can do a convincing job with only 15 seconds of sample audio.
Jeez.
Which for a lot of people would be their outgoing voicemail message.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So imagine that.
Right.
All I have to do is call you. You're not going to answer the phone because it's from an unknown number. Your voicemail message plays, and I use that to clone your voice.
Right.
Yeah. So awareness is crucial. So make sure you share that with your friends and family. And then last but certainly not least is this notion of emotional manipulation.
Right.
And it's important to maintain your skepticism and avoid impulsive decisions because these folks are going to do everything they can to mess with your mind and put you in a state where you're not thinking rationally.
Right. Now, I have gone through and talked to all my family members.
Yeah.
I've said this before, but I've told them I'm never going to call them and ask them for money.
Mm-hmm.
That's not
what I'm saying. But Joe, you always call and ask us for money.
Right.
Say, no, I haven't been in college for a long time, Mom.
Right. Come on, dude.
Right.
Yeah. So no, I've actually gone through the trouble and said, you know, my voice is out there a lot.
Yeah.
There's tons of availability. If somebody wanted to clone my voice, they would have no trouble doing it.
Right.
They could probably even use this piece of data right here. Although I would like to say that my voice should never be cloned.
Oh?
Yes. I'm just going to say that.
Oh, I see. Just, you're trying to mess up the training data?
Right. I'm trying to maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
It's good. It's good.
What am I doing here? I'm just wasting the listeners' time.
Well, this article from Wired is a good one. It's particularly a good one to send around to your friends and family. You know, share it on your groups online and, you know, work email, work newsletters, things like that. It's just real good general awareness for protecting yourself against these AI scam calls. So highly recommended, and we will have a link to that in the show notes. All right, Joe, it is time to move on to our catch of the day.
Dave, our catch of the day comes from Jay, who sent us a LinkedIn post by Chris Stones, which is about an in-person scam. We've never actually had an in-person scam catch of the day. In fact, when Jay sent this to us, he said, I don't think this would be a good catch of the day, but it might be a good story. But I think it would be a great catch of the day.
Okay.
So it is a story, so I'm just going to ask you to read Chris's story.
All right. Chris writes, this morning at Piccadilly train station, I was getting some cash out of one of the machines when a well-dressed 50-something professional-looking lady approached me. She said, I wonder if you can help me. I'm en route to London and have just realized I've left my purse at home. If I transfer £50 to your account now, would you be able to give me the cash? Keep in mind, this was around 6:20 and pre-first coffee, so I wasn't at my sharpest, but before I'd even digested the question, she thrust her phone at me, preloaded with her HSBC app open, showing that she had around £79,000 in her current account and clearly was good for it. My spidey sense kicked in, and whilst ordinarily I do enjoy winding scammers up and dragging it out until they realize I'm toying with them, in this instance, with a Costa to queue for and a train to catch, I went with a straight no. Her reaction was superb, fake, and loud indignation. Do I look like a scammer to you? Do I really look like a scammer? I'm so offended.
Then, you didn't look like a scammer until just now. yes, you look like a scammer.
Yeah. Then proceeded to stomp off to the nearest exit, not platform 6 to Euston, but as previously suggested. Before exiting, however, she returned and shouted, leave your pants in the 90s, which I thought was hilarious, as chinos never go out of fashion. All right.
what exactly are chinos?
Chinos? They're like, when I think of chinos, I think of like a beige, semi-casual sort of pant.
Like a khaki?
Yeah, like a khaki.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I would describe as a chino. Chris goes on and says, I reported her to a station employee whilst waiting for my commuter coffee and left it at that, but it has niggled me on the train. What's the point of this post? general awareness, I suppose. This isn't a new or innovative scam for sure, but the presentation was. The woman had a nice travel bag, a laptop bag, was well-dressed, and this initially made me doubt my gut feeling. Trust your gut, folks. If it looks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it usually is a duck.
Indeed.
So what's the scam here, Joe?
The scam is that he's going to give her 50 bucks and she's going to fake transfer 50 bucks to him.
Yeah.
From her 75,000 or 79,000 pound balance.
Right.
Right. And so she can take the train somewhere. But he's never going to get the 50 bucks.
Yeah. So it's probably could be a scam app on her phone that looks like a banking app, but it's not.
Right. It's not an app. It's just another app. We talked about this last week as well.
Yeah.
With the guy that stole the laptop from the people. This seems to be a common thing in the UK where they have these fake apps and they pretend to send money to you and get something in return.
Yeah.
And you get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the perfect crime, Dave. By the time you realize what's up, you're far away.
Right, right. All right, well, thank you, Jay, for sending that in. And we will have a link to that post from Chris Stones over on LinkedIn. We'll have that link in our show notes. We were talking about mitigating cyber threats to your organization before your users even see them. The new Phish ER Plus from KnowBefore was developed to help you supercharge your organization's email security defenses. How? You get a unique crowdsourcing advantage. More than 10 million highly trained KnowBefore end users from across the globe catch and report malicious email that makes it through all the filters. KnowBefore's Threat Lab then validates it with AI and with human researchers. Phish ER Plus blocks phishing threads other tools have missed and proactively removes them from your users' inboxes. Not quite time travel, but we think you'll agree it's a vital capability in any InfoSec professional's arsenal. Visit KnowBefore.com/products/PhishER-Plus to learn more. That's KnowBefore.com/products/PhishER-Plus. And we thank KnowBefore for sponsoring our show. Joe, I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Trevin Edgeworth, a Red Team Practice Director for Bishop Fox, which is a cybersecurity organization. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about account compromises at X, the company formerly known as Twitter. Here's my conversation with Trevin Edgeworth.
I think it just shows that the bigger you are, the more you can possibly potentially be targeted. If you're in the line of fire, if you have some kind of business service or functionality that an attacker needs, requires in order to achieve their attack objectives, then there's confidence. There's no fear about going after even large targets like the SEC.
I think a lot of folks were surprised to see a security company like Mandiant fall victim to this sort of thing. I suppose one lesson to be taken from that is that this could happen to anyone. But at the same time, I think folks are left scratching their heads that an organization that prominent wouldn't have had more security in place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it goes to show in my profession, a lot of times it's like we're approaching a giant thick wall. And from the outset, it looks like this walled fortress. And then there's a tiny little crack in that wall. And so you pull out your scalpel and you're kind of analyzing that crack. And before you know it, that entire wall has crumbled because small things can ultimately turn into very significant exposures. And in this case, it was a case of multiple situations that were chained together to pull off that heist, and one of which being that they were able to switch the phone number associated with the account to a different device. So that was a key issue. And then they were able to get a credential changed on that. So just a couple small things, and suddenly they can take over an account that can be used for their purposes.
For folks who aren't familiar with red teaming and what goes into that, can you give us a little overview of the kinds of things that you and your team there at Bishop Fox do?
Sure, absolutely. So again, I'm the Red Team Practice Director for Bishop Fox, and I lead a very extraordinary and talented team. We do all things related to what we call adversary emulation. So external and assumed breach Red Team engagements, collaborative Purple Teaming work. We do incident response tabletops. We do ransomware simulations, physical breaches, social engineering, and we even help companies build their own internal red team programs. As for red teaming in general, red teaming is a concept that has a lot of different meanings. It can mean just applying adversarial thought. And in that sense, you can red team an idea through debate or analysis to pressure test it. In fact, you on your podcast are often debating ideas and things. So essentially, you're red teaming an idea there. But with respect to the industry, it's one of many different forms of offensive security testing that's used to find security gaps and to test an organization's resilience to actual breach scenarios. In other words, if we do things just as an adversary would that organization, first of all, detect those things and properly respond to them? And secondly, are they even possible to do within the environment, or are there protections in place to prevent that? So in its most simple form, I refer to it as objective-based adversary emulation. Objective-based in the sense that a lot of offensive security forms and methodologies start from a standpoint of a scope. It might be a network range or an IP address or a web application or something like that. Whereas red teams actually start with attacker trophies and objectives. And those objectives could be to perform an unauthorized wire transfer, or to get an ATM to spit out cash and to delete a mortgage, or to spy on an executive boardroom, or even to stop a train. In fact, all of those are actual trophies that my different teams through the years have had in past red team engagements. And by starting with that objective, you detach from a very specifically defined scope. There might be ways to perform that wire transfer outside of the traditional SWIFT or system that we're looking at. In other words, we could social engineer wire operators. We could get access to a wire room and those types of things. So red teaming allows you to kind of open up the avenues of creativity on that. And then adversary emulation just means that we're doing things just as an adversary would, as closely as possible to their playbooks, using their same tactics, techniques, and procedures. And that way a customer can see how they do against the real thing, except that unlike that nefarious attacker, we're actually sharing all of our notes to help them to actually get better and to get stronger. So in a way, we're kind of our customer's sparring partner to help them prepare for the real fight.
Can you give us some examples of the kind of things that happen as you gear up for an engagement here? I mean, let's say I'm a medium-sized business, maybe a few dozen employees, something like that. Where do you begin? How do you decide what sort of things you're going to do?
That's a really great question. A lot of organizations will come to us and say, we know we want a red team. We could use some help kind of understanding how to craft that scenario. And that's where I start to lick my chops, because I come from more of a threat intel background and red team. And I can try to ask a lot of questions around what's their business and what are they, how are you structured and how do you engage your customers and interface with other outsiders? And I can kind of put the hat of an attacker, of a nefarious attacker on and say, these, and also try to understand the available strategic threat intelligence around those particular industry verticals. Say it's somebody coming from manufacturing, I can go and check and see what attackers are actually targeting manufacturing and from what countries and what cybercrime groups and things and what are their TTPs. And then I can kind of translate that into, here's what we recommend that you are most likely susceptible to or most likely going to be in the crosshairs against. And so we will kind of talk through that scenario and the customer will give us the thumbs up or maybe we can think this through a little further. So it really is customized for every individual. But one of the key ways that we do reach an idea as to a really strong operation idea is through a process called architecture and attack graphing. So we'll kind of understand with the customer all of the core technologies that they have in use. Are they on-prem or are they in the cloud? What do they use for their email gateway? What are the technologies that they use on their endpoints and for authentication for MFA? And then we translate that into attack graphing, which is these are the top 5, 6, 7, 10, 20 scenarios where an outside attacker or a malicious insider are likely to target your unique business. And it's highly tailored towards every customer. And through that, we can really kind of zero in on scenarios that are most effective for them to test out.
What are some of the things that, you would consider to be low-hanging fruit? You know, the things you run into time and time again. You know, if only most companies did this, then we wouldn't have some of the issues that we have.
Oh boy, this is a wonderful question, and I'm glad you asked it. Is that it, surprisingly, even though specific findings often change from one operation to another, from one customer to another, but after having done this for many, many years, you wouldn't believe how often they fall under the same five or six different concepts. And one of them is lack of micro-segmentation within organizations. They tend to, if you get access and entry point into any part of the network, it's just too easy to move from one point to the other. Number two would be lack of secrets management. So often customers and developers and others will leave credentials in insecure locations like Confluence or GitHub or different places where they can easily be compromised, or even on in Excel spreadsheets on a machine. Another one of those is elevated user access rights. I would think if you don't need access to do a certain thing, that the company would not want to actually give you that. But you wouldn't believe the number of people that have local administrator rights, full administrator privileges of their own machines, and they just don't need it. There are things that they can do to kind of bump that down. And then I would also say lack of detections around security incidents are often, things that we really should be caught on are just, we're able to kind of stay under the radar through things like living off the land, looking like a normal user, and doing those types of things. So those are kind of the key, I would say, four areas that organizations kind of seem to struggle with, and they enable legitimate attacks as well as red team attacks to happen and succeed. Mm.
And what about the human side of things? You know, when we talk about things like security awareness training and, you know, that kind of stuff, what part does that play from your point of view?
Oh, wow. You know, it's actually one of my absolute favorite. If I have a favorite area of red teaming, it is that human element. Throughout my career, I've had an opportunity to analyze a lot of the breaches on the CTI side, on the cyber threat intelligence side, and actually performing breaches legally and ethically on the red team side. And so I've gotten to see a lot of real world attack chains and breach scenarios that are played out. And I've always been particularly fascinated by attacks that, number one, involve a social element to them. And number two, involve some form of timing to them, or capitalizing on a certain window of opportunity that's based on what's happening either at the target organization or in the world around them. Because one of the most essential skill sets for red teaming is having situational awareness and knowing that target environment and using what each environment's giving to you in terms of attack surface and potential pathways. So you want to understand, what is this business? How do they do business? How do they interact with customers and third parties? And that is important. But sometimes what that environment is giving you is not so much the technical in nature, what operating systems they're using or what tools and things they're using, but rather more event-based and more situational, that are based on changes or key things that are happening in that world or at the target environment. So from a business, IT, or other standpoint, for example, maybe the timing of a major press release or an earnings report, or maybe it's a change to a new work from home or a return to work strategy in that company that might be advertised publicly. It could even be something that's focused on kind of a peak busy period or a particularly quiet time, like a major holiday at the organization or even world events there. Often events and change can create windows of opportunity for attackers, sometimes even more so than a target's technology or people or processes do.
How often does it come to pass, if at all, where, you engage with an organization and, I don't know, I'm imagining, as security personnel somewhere thinking that, our regulatory regime says that we have to have these tests, but this is a checkbox thing and, have at it, good luck to you. We're buttoned up tight. And then they're in for a little rude awakening.
Exactly. Yeah, you're exactly right. I call that bottom-up security as opposed to kind of top-down security. Bottom-up security is maybe a CISO listening on this podcast is this may resonate a little too closely to them, but they're going up and down the vendor aisles of a conference and they're saying, let's keep this on the, I want this. I want this. They're like a kid in a candy shop and realizing I need all these tools, right? And I mean, well, that's something we hadn't thought of. Let's do that. Or they're starting from a standpoint of regulatory. We need to be secure in the ways that PCI says that we're secure. And PCI is not evil. It does actually help us to check certain boxes, but it does not equate necessarily to security. Now, top-down security, that CISO would have a strong understanding of, number one, their business, how it operates, and what their crown jewels are for each of their specific lines of business. That might be for a hospitality company. It might be their reservation management system, which maintains PII and PCI data across all of their customers, as well as the reservation data. It might be different types of systems like your Active Directory and things. And then together, you would actually think through, based on that information, as well as what threat actors are targeting you. Again, you can do that through the process of operation planning, like with the red team. You can then understand these are the most likely threat scenarios in our risk management process that are likely to hit us and likely to be impacted by us. And therefore, you can figure out what controls are needed in order to stop each and every one of those. That is proper top-down security leadership. And that's those are usually the organizations that fend particularly well against the real thing, as well as red team operations.
Hmm. What sort of advice do you have for our listeners? You know, folks who are just your regular everyday person going about their day, minding their business, doing the things they do online. The experience that you have as a red teamer, how do you protect yourself? How do you advise members of your family, your loved ones, for the types of things that they can do that aren't overwhelming?
Sure. When it comes to social engineering attacks, specifically, we all have this internal gauge. And I don't know about you, but I used to love gaming. I still do a little bit of gaming. I fit it in where I can. But I used to play a lot of that original Far Cry. And in Far Cry, there's this concept, I think they call it a stealth-o-meter or a stealth meter. And it's this meter on the screen that as you get closer and closer to an enemy, or maybe you're exposed out in the open in the sunlight, or you make a noise, well, that stealth-o-meter changes from green to yellow to red. And then before you know it, your enemy is kind of calling for backup, and now it's 5-1. And so I've often, had a sort of similar image to that in my head when I'm doing social engineering, that your targets all have a something's wrong meter. And the attacker's pretext either assuages or that meter or nudges it more towards the red. And so for an attacker truly looking to evade detection, it's about subtly including key bits of information that might suggest that you're safe, that you're an insider, that you can be trusted, and that you're not a threat. And so offering little bits of information really can be any number of things, like it can be knowing specific terms that your organization or your the communities that you're involved in might use. It might be knowledge of the internal environment or your home situation or what your family's up to and those types of things. And if you can subtly weave in two or three of those kinds of things, people initially will start with a high stealth-o-meter in the red or yellow, and they eventually lower their guard. So my advice for people is really to just constantly be vigilant and thoughtful around why is this person contacting me? And just to realize that things can seem very, very real, but you still need to continue to ask the questions as to why did they contact me and not me, them, for example, a bank reaching out regarding a weird transaction or something. And so it's just I think it's just heeding that that stealth-o-meter in general, because generally that's going to be spot on. That's going to help us to understand something's not right. Stop, pause, and ask questions or reach out to somebody who may be more well-versed in some of these types of scenarios to help you out.
Joe, what do you think?
Dave, big organizations are always going to be targets for malicious actors.
Yeah.
Small organizations are also always going to be targets for malicious actors. The only difference with the small organization is you actually stand less of a chance to get targeted, but when they do target you, you may not be prepared for them.
Mm.
So think about that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a small organization, think about it. It's interesting that the SEC and Mandiant both had been had their Twitter account or X accounts. Can we just say X now?
I say X Twitter because X-Twitter? To me that's clear.
Because you're an X Twitter user, right?
I am an X Twitter user. Yes, I'd say X Twitter because it's X and Twitter, and it's X Twitter because it's no longer Twitter. And just using the word X, it is horrible, especially in the spoken word. So I think X Twitter provides more clarity for our listeners.
Okay.
So that's what I've decided to go with.
Well, I'm going to go with that too then.
All right.
I'll keep up with the journalism standards.
There you go.
The SEC takeover was done with a SIM swap.
Mm-hmm.
And X Twitter blamed the SEC for this. And I kind of have mixed feelings about this. Maybe, maybe they should have gone... the SEC should not have been using a cell phone for multi-factor authentication here. I would think that if I were in charge of the SEC, I think I would have used some kind of universal two-factor method of multi-factor authentication here.
Okay.
I think that's warranted for the SEC. I think it's warranted for any Fortune 1000 company, any large company, any publicly traded company, I think it's warranted for.
Yeah.
I think it's such a low friction thing. Just put it on all your accounts.
Yeah.
I remember this. This was a very effective attack because what they did was they went out and announced that the SEC was going to allow a Bitcoin ETF.
Right.
And that drove the price of Bitcoin very quickly up a lot. So somebody made a ton of money here,
mm-hmm.
And that was the plan all along. They bought some Bitcoin, made the announcement through the SEC's Twitter or X Twitter page, and then sold the Bitcoin.
Yeah,
Mandiant had their account taken over, and they ran some other kind of crypto scam where they impersonated a crypto wallet.
Mm-hmm.
Probably didn't get as much. They didn't get as much. I don't think, but I think the SEC attack was almost certainly way more profitable.
Yeah, although I'd say you can't discount the amount of reputational harm that Mandiant got for having their...
Yes, because Mandiant is a cybersecurity company.
Right, right.
Somebody
had a very bad day at Mandiant when that happened.
Yes, the very bad day scenario.
Yeah.
I like the term that Trevin uses, objective-based adversary emulation. Mm. And objective-based is a good way to think about threat modeling. This reminds me of Schneier's attack trees.
Okay.
Which in that you think about what's the goal, right? And then what would be necessary to accomplish that goal all the way down to the end unit. You just build trees out to what you have to do in order to compromise the end goal.
Mm.
So you start with the objective and you think about how to get there, essentially. This is what bad actors are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the adversary emulation. These actors are going to do anything they can to get to the objective. So emulate that.
Mm.
Now, when I say that, I think that there are certain places where you don't emulate what they're going to do, right? Like, I don't think in the phishing exercises you say, big bonus coming, click here, right?
Right, right.
All that does is alienate your employees. So, temper this with common sense.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to quantify that.
Common sense and humanity.
Right, humanity. That's right.
right.
It's important to, I think it's important to understand how adversaries view you. And I think that having somebody who's skilled in adversarial thinking really helps with that.
Okay.
Something like a white hat person who thinks adversarially.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that when Trevin is talking about the four different problems that they just keep seeing over and over and over again, like no micro segmentation mm-hmm. on your network, no secrets management, and that sometimes these secrets are just laid out on GitHub. I can't think of a worse place to keep a secret.
Right.
The elevated user access. Local admin is not necessary for most users. If you have a development team, they might need to have local admin. If you have an accounting team, they don't need to have local admin.
Yeah.
And they probably shouldn't. And then lack of detection technologies. Detection is one of the big parts of knowing that there's a problem. This is why this is such an issue is the average amount of time that an attacker stays in a network before he's detected is months.
Right.
Months of time. And the amount of damage that an attacker can do in that time is astronomical.
Yeah.
So it's very important to be able to know when they're in. And finally, I wanted to talk about the interesting conversation you guys had around the issue of timing. Timing is key in a lot of these attacks. If someone is targeting your organization, you can bet they're watching every press release that you release that comes out. They have a subscription to PR Newswire. They're watching all the news reports about you. They know what's going on. And the first thing they're thinking about all these things is, how can I exploit this article or this press release or this fact? How can I do that? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing they're thinking about. So timing can really helps make it look like a phone call might make sense. But I don't know. I think people need to think, this seems a little bit suspicious. The timing's a little on the nose. Mm. That being said, I don't know that you're going to be able to get most people to think that way.
Yeah.
It's kind of difficult. So just understand, I think right now all I can say is understand the timing. Understand that timing works against you in these kind of situations. If there's a big press release that your company's just laid out, maybe you tell people, let's watch out for scams around this subject.
I think it's an interesting conversation you could have, let's say, in a tabletop exercise or an executive meeting to say, hey, let's brainstorm. Let's look at our year, right? Our company's year. What are the things that we do throughout the year, timing-wise, where we would be at our most vulnerable and why? And just have people think about that.
Right.
Is it the release of our numbers? Is it the release of a new product? Is it, who knows? Every company could have millions of different things, but thinking about that, making a list, you know, I think could help bring the awareness that organizations need to maybe try to combat that.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea.
It's an interesting problem that I don't know that we've talked about this exact issue ever before.
Yeah.
But yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks for bringing it up, Trevin.
Yeah, and our thanks to Trevin Edgeworth for joining us. Again, he is the Red Team Practice Director for Bishop Fox, and we do appreciate him taking the time. We want to thank all of you for listening, and of course, we want to thank our sponsors at Know Before. They are experts in helping users do the right thing through new school security awareness training. That is our show. We want to thank all of you for listening. Our thanks to the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute for their participation. You can learn more at isi.jhu.edu. A quick reminder that N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. Our executive producer is Jennifer Iben. This show is mixed by Trey Hester. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie. I'm Dave Bittner.
And I'm Joe Kerrigan.
Thanks for listening.